This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Today, we'll check in as Indiana lawmakers return to the State House for this year's 2021 session, and after a tense political week nationally, as protests are planned this weekend at the State House. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a high-quality voice message with our smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. And we're joined now by Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Hi, Brandon. How are you?
I'm great, Jill. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Now, I want to get to what's going on at the State House, you know, back for a full week this week. But I did want to touch on, you know, the national involvement, Indiana lawmakers this week. Of course, a historic week, the second time the president's been impeached ever. You know, is there anything standing out as far as some Indiana congressmen or women reactions to the events in the nation?
Not really, no. We saw a split among Indiana Republican federal lawmakers last week around certification of the election results. But this week in the House, it was along party lines as far as Indiana goes. Now, we saw this is the most bipartisan impeachment in history. 10 Republicans crossed party lines in the U.S. House to vote to impeach President Trump, but none of those were Hoosiers. All seven of Indiana's Republican federal lawmakers in the House voted not to impeach, while the two Democrats, Frank Vervan in the 1st District and Andre Carson here in the 7th District in Indianapolis, voted to impeach. So in that sense, yeah, really not surprising at all, pretty much what you would have expected.
None of us expected, well, at least I didn't, last week's storming of the Capitol and the riots that went on in the Capitol. And obviously now we're hearing of protests all the way across the nation in all 50 states, and Indiana included in this call for protests. I understand you'll be, you know, at the State House this weekend, making sure that we're on top of that.
Yeah, on Sunday is kind of when we're expecting, if something significant is going to happen, it seems likely to be Sunday at noon, some sort of protest at the State House, not inside, outside. As far as I'm aware, the State House is closed on Sunday, as it is every week. It's always closed on Sundays. We also have the latest we've gotten from the FBI here in Indianapolis is that there are no specific threats. We heard the same from Governor Holcomb and State Police Superintendent Doug Carter earlier this week, that there have been no specific threats made about Indiana or the State House. So I'm not really sure what to expect Sunday. We don't expect certainly the violence that we saw in Washington, D.C., or that we potentially might see elsewhere around the country this coming weekend or over the coming days leading up to President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. But as State Police Superintendent Doug Carter did say, all hands are on deck. The National Guard, the State Police, IMP Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department here in Indy, obviously because that's where the State House is, and state agencies, federal agencies, they're all making sure that nothing goes wrong.
Yeah, the response now is pretty comprehensive, it seems. This week, first week back for Indiana lawmakers, you know, this is the first time, too, that Indiana lawmakers have been back, you know, full time at the State House since the pandemic. You know, what's the feeling there as we get started this year?
It's uneven. It's a lot different. It looks a lot different. It feels a lot different. The Indiana House, for instance, isn't meeting in the Indiana House chamber. They've made a temporary makeshift house chamber in the Indiana Government Center South, which is part of the state government complex here in downtown Indianapolis. They took over like three or four conference rooms, combined them into one huge space that will accommodate more social distancing. Committee hearings are happening very differently in a lot of ways. In several committee hearings in both the House and Senate, we have lawmakers in one room, and then anybody who wants to testify in a separate room connected via video stream, which has been, you know, obviously a weird experience, too. So they're trying their best, but it's also been uneven. We saw this week, for instance, a bill over whether companies can require their workers to get vaccinations. We saw dozens of people in support of that bill refuse to wear masks and sort of take over a committee room with no mask wearing, enough that other people who wanted to testify on the measure actually had to leave because they were worried about their safety and health.
I mean, is that a real concern, you know, as we move forward, that people will be deterred from testifying because of this?
It's absolutely a concern. And I think it's why we saw the next day, as reporters talked to Republican legislative leaders, Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray, Speaker Todd Houston, we asked about this issue. And both of them were kind of on the same page, which is that's not acceptable. We're talking with the Capitol Police who work the State House to make sure that mask wearing is being enforced in the building. It is required. Every entrance you walk through and into this building here at the State House says masks are required to do business here. But obviously it wasn't being enforced this week, certainly at that committee hearing. So they are working with them to make sure it does happen, because it's for the exact reason you just talked about. They want people to feel like they can come to the State House, testify in a committee hearing, be part of the democratic process, part of the legislative process, and not feel worried for their safety.
Yeah, super important. You know, obviously, with the pandemic, a lot of bills will be related around everything that we're going through right now. I understand there's some important information or some important proposals, vaccination rollout. What sort of bills are we seeing around vaccinations?
Yeah, I mean, the one we've seen so far directly dealing with vaccinations is actually the opposite direction, which is that bill I just mentioned, which mm-hmm. would ban companies from requiring their workers to get vaccinated in some circumstances, going a little further than current law already does. But in terms of the vaccine rollout, we've seen that more on the administrative level. The big step made this week by the administration, Hoosiers 70 and older can now schedule appointments for the vaccine. You can do that at ourshot.in.gov or by calling 211. They are also there to answer questions about the vaccine. And the next step will be for those 60 and older. So dropping that age limit down another 10 years. We don't know when that will happen because it's really determined on how much of the vaccine Indiana is getting, which it doesn't know exactly how much, basically week to week. They have expectations, but they don't actually know how much they'll get until the week arrives. So that's their plan, but timelines are hard to nail down because so much of this response from a sort of federal level has been really lackluster.
Yeah. My parents got their appointment. They called in that first day and they were able to get an appointment, but not till February. So long waits for people too.
Yeah.
If this is a budget year, you know, what are we looking at when we're considering Holcomb's budget proposal this year?
Yeah, we have the governor's. So that's always the way this goes. The governor proposes their budget in January, and then we'll get the House Republicans in February and the Senate Republicans after that, probably in March. But Governor Holcomb's proposal, the budget situation overall looks a lot better than I think a lot of people thought it was, because with the pandemic, state finances seem to be crashing. We thought we were in for a really bad year, but things have recovered in a lot of ways, due in part to state revenues improving more than expected, federal help, with COVID relief dollars, some of those being used to help the budget. And then, how state agencies have been able to make cuts. And because of all that, Indiana is going to have a lot of money in its reserves in the next few years, including this year. And Governor Holcomb wants to spend over $1 billion over the next 2 years, mostly out of those reserves, really focused on paying down state debt, almost none of it for direct relief for Hoosiers struggling during the pandemic. And Republican legislative leaders, while they don't hate the idea of paying down debt, aren't sure that, you know, they talked a lot about the need for balance. So Governor Holcomb's proposal is the first of, like I said, many to come. So it's just a starting point, and we'll see what legislators have to say in the coming weeks and months.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see what both sides are saying on that. Something that got a little movement already, the police reform bill, obviously such a huge issue that we heard about from community members this summer. What did that look like?
Yeah, I'm a little surprised at how far it goes, though, of course, there are lots of folks who wanted to go a lot farther. But what we saw, House Committee unanimously passed the House Republican police reform bill. But while it has support of law enforcement groups from around the state, it also has support of the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus, the NAACP, the Indiana Black Expo, the Urban League here in Indy. So groups on both sides of this debate. It bans chokeholds in most circumstances, unless deadly force is warranted. It allows the state to more easily decertify police officers, which would essentially prevent them from being cops any longer if they commit misconduct. It requires de-escalation training for all police officers in Indiana. It also requires police departments to share full employment records when a police officer is looking for a new job at a different department. And we heard from the state police that a lot of times that sharing just wasn't going on, which allows a bad cop to kind of move easily from one job to another because their new employer doesn't necessarily know about the problems in their past. So all of those things widely supported. They were part of the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus's much more robust police reform agenda. I don't see a lot more happening on that, though, of course, folks will push for it. But just that alone is a bigger step than I think some thought would happen.
Interesting. As a former health reporter, I have to ask about the cigarette tax, you know, something that we've been talking about for so many years, you know, as Indiana lawmakers have been pressured by so many groups to, you know, raise the cigarette tax. I'm hearing that there may be some movement this year.
Yeah, I think it has its best chance that it's had in a really long time. And that's because of the pandemic. Mm. You know, we know that Indiana's poor health record hurts the state. But when you have a pandemic around a disease that affects people with heart conditions, obesity, lung conditions, well, Indiana's fourth highest smoking rate in the country makes the situation exponentially worse. So I think that's sort of helping rally some lawmakers to the idea of, because the point of raising the cigarette tax is not really about the money it's going to generate, because it's really about stopping people from smoking, because the data tells us that that is the best way to either stop people from smoking to begin with or to help them quit. And that will help Indiana's overall health record, which has been, you know, revealed to be, we already knew it was bad. The pandemic has shown a brighter light on that.
Yeah. Have about 30 seconds. Anything else that we should really be looking at as we have the rest of the session?
Oh, there's a million things. But one thing that's moving quickly is guaranteeing 100% of state funding for K-12 schools this year that they were already expecting, regardless of whether the students were learning in person or virtually. That's something schools really need, and it's already well on the move in both chambers.
Super important. Thank you, Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Thanks so much, Brandon.
Thank you.
And we'll be back after a quick break here. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can always let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. We're talking today about a push to find more adult mentors for children in Indiana. Indiana Youth Institute President and CEO Tammy Silverman joins us now. Thanks so much for taking time, Tammy.
Always my pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
You know, it is Mentoring Month. Can you tell us an initiative from the Indiana Youth Institute, Mentor Indiana? What is that?
First and foremost, I would say it's where IYI is happy to be the lead on Mentor Indiana and the promotion, but it is actually a national celebration. It's National Mentoring Month, and we talk about mentors are valuable each and every month, but like so many things, we like to have one time a year where we really highlight and talk about what are those benefits of mentoring, and then hope that we can talk through and encourage some folks to maybe volunteer and let this be part of their new 2021 plans and help them see how it can benefit them as well to sign up to be a mentor.
How long has Indiana Youth Institute been a part of this program then?
Yes, we've been doing it since 2008. We've been doing it a while, and we have the great opportunity to work with just outstanding quality mentor programs across our state. So, you know, from Evansville to Fort Wayne to Gary, back down to Jeffersonville and everything in between, there are wonderful, high-quality mentoring programs in many, many of our communities.
You know, you talked about sort of the goal is to increase engagement. How do we do that? How do we best do that, you know, especially today?
Yes. Well, first and foremost, I think we can talk a little bit about what does it mean to be a mentor? Sometimes sometimes I think as adults, if we're thinking about doing this and signing up to be a mentor, there's some confusion on tutoring versus mentoring. And we often hear, I'm not trained, right? Like, I don't have the right, I'm not sure I have the right skills. I don't know today's calculus or geometry or whatever that might be, or that they don't have particular, that an adult might not have particular training in child development. And actually, neither of those are requirements, right? So what we're really talking about is you need to be caring, you need to be dedicated so that you can give a period of time, and then you have to engage with one of these programs that is really high quality. And we do, as part of Mentor Indiana, distinguish between quality mentoring programs, and again, that's a national kind of standard that was developed with programs, talk about, you know, these are programs that are going to let both parties know what's involved. They're going to do some screening. They're going to have an application. They're going to do ongoing support and training. So it's not, you know, neither the mentor or mentee should ever feel like they're trying to go it alone without that support.
I mean, it must be difficult to get people involved, especially, you know, if they don't even, you know, realize that the opportunities are out there. But there are lots of opportunities for people to get involved being a caring adult in a child's life.
There are an awful lot of opportunities. There's a great number of kids that are waiting to be mentors. I know not too long ago, I checked in with Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Central Indiana, and they had quite a lengthy list of kids that were waiting, mentees that were waiting for mentors. And I have to believe that's the same across the state. So yes, there's a number that are waiting. Sometimes as adults, we think we don't have time. We don't. We're not sure how we can work it. Maybe you have your own kids. Maybe you have a busy job. And yet, I will tell you, one of the most encouraging things you can do is talk to someone who has actually been a mentor. They consistently say they got as much, if not more, out of it, that they benefited, that, you know, it does take like any new activity that you're going to do. It takes a little while to develop that pattern and to make that space. But everyone says it's well worth it, and it far exceeds their expectations.
So what we're talking about here is, you know, it's hard to fathom for some people, I'm sure, that children don't have a caring, supportive adult in their lives, but the statistics show that that in fact many children are in this situation.
Right. Well, you know, again, I think often think about in your own life, Who were those adults that maybe stepped in and made a pivotal difference in your life that weren't your family members? Because again, one of the great benefits of being a mentor, sometimes kids can accept advice or coaching or guidance differently from an outside force, right? Than they might from mom or dad or even a caring aunt or grandma or whatever that might be. So think about, we all probably, hopefully, have one or two of those people. So if we can, these programs facilitate that on a regular basis. So thinking about that, kids need that outside kind of different voice, right? That can help coach them and mentor them. And at the same time, kids can't have too much support. So even the kids that perhaps do have a family support network, this adds a different dimension to that, and this can help them. And again, some of the data on the benefits of mentoring, you know, we look at this on a somewhat regular basis, particularly every January when we update the numbers, but the outcomes and the benefits to young people are just astonishing.
Yeah, talk about some of that research. I mean, the information shows that there's just a myriad of advantages.
Yes, and I know many of us are talking, there's a lot of programs on post-secondary success. So young people who have a mentor are 55% more likely to be enrolled in college. They're 81% more likely to participate regularly, which is an important term there, in sports and extracurricular activities. They're 78% more likely to volunteer, which then gets into that civic engagement and community connections. And they're also more than twice as likely to hold some leadership position while they're in school, which again translates to those life skills and leadership skills that benefit them in the long run. So those are, you know, I think for if we think about a lot of programs, if you could get those kind of outcomes across the board and that kind of return on your investment, I mean, mentoring is a fantastic way to make a big difference for our future generations.
What does the data tell us here in Indiana specifically? How are we doing building these programs and really reaching youth?
Yes, there's always a need for more, I think, is the big perhaps takeaway. And that being said, you know, we know that 1 in 3 young people will grow up without a mentor, and that there's still that gap in demand. That being said, we have some tremendous programs. We often start by thinking about Big Brothers, Big Sisters, and in many of our communities, they are the kind of the gold standard that has paved the way. That being said, there are other programs that are out there as well that may be equally as strong of a fit for a particular child. I think of College Mentors for Kids, which is kind of neat in that it matches younger people, college students, with younger students. And so there's that connection. 100 Black Men in Indianapolis is another one of those great programs. But actually, we have on our website, you can go in and type in your zip code, and it'll pull up programs that are around you. So you can find what's available in your area, as well as, I would also say, the United Ways in many communities, as well as the community foundations, have a really good handle on what are some of these mentoring opportunities that are available locally.
The majority of the mentoring opportunities that are, you know, quality mentoring are from nonprofit groups, some of the ones that you mentioned, a lot of them very well known, like you think of Big Brothers, Big Sisters. Are some of the smaller groups, you know, doing this work as well? And are we seeing more of that on a local level? Because, you know, maybe people are more likely to become engaged through a smaller grassroots group.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're seeing it's both and, right? And so that's a great question in that we are seeing that a smaller number of higher ed institutions are actually starting some of these mentoring programs, as well as faith-based institutions. And so a lot of folks are used to going to their church or their place of worship. And so that may be a great way to start, right? And they may have one of those mentoring programs. And so absolutely, as long as we said, like, the idea is to make sure that they have those standards in place, both to help the mentor understand, but obviously most importantly to make sure that the mentees are safe and protected and there's an intentionality around working with young people there. But great question about those local organizations and smaller institutions that we might not often think about.
You write that, you know, that there could be a negative impact of poor mentoring programs. What might that look like, and how can people be aware then?
Yes, and you don't, you know, you want to highlight all those great outcomes, and at the same time, we do need to be aware of what some of the challenges are. A lot of the kids that come and are requesting a mentor have had adults in their lives let them down, right? They've had chances where they couldn't rely on, and they may be rightfully pretty skeptical of adults who say, we want to show up and help you. And so one of the intentionalities of these quality programs is a consistency factor. They often ask, can you volunteer for a period of time so that this young person knows that they can count on you? And if something, you know, things happen, right? Somebody has to move or whatever, they have a plan for continuing that support for that young person. Because the last thing that anybody wants to do, right, everyone wants this to be a positive for both the mentee and the mentor, is we don't want to disappoint that mentee again. And we don't want, you know, we want to kind of reverse perhaps some of those negative experiences they had. We don't want to perpetuate that.
And some of the best practices then include, you know, a lot of screening, it looks like, training. These are lengthy processes for maybe a small group as well to undergo.
They can be. I think they're pretty efficient. You know, I think our folks that have been doing it a while have, it's a realistic, you know, it's that balancing of they need to be thorough enough, but we don't want to have such a delay to getting the programs. And they're doing a great job of that. You know, occasionally we also hear folks talk about, well, we don't want it to be another parent, right? Like this, and the mentoring programs understand that as well. It's not intended to take the place of a parent. It's intended to supplement and add more support to that child's life. And so I would just say, you know, we know that there are kids that have a lot of support that still benefit from a mentor. I can't honestly think of a situation where a child doesn't benefit from more caring adults you know, supporting them and guiding them through their development as a young person.
That's good. That's good to hear then. And certainly we know that, you know, there's certain factors that, that play into whether or not a child needs a mentor in their lives. And we're going to see disparity in those factors across a state like Indiana.
We are. And we, again, we need to lean into those disparities. We need to understand them. And we need to try to solve for them or at least address them. And so really thinking about if we're engaging with schools or groups that may not have all the opportunities, how can we make sure that we're addressing that and that we're leaning in a little bit more to make sure those kids, you know, we all know that it's important for all of our kids to be healthy, safe, well-supported so that they can be those productive adults. Some kids are well on their way and they kind of got a jump start on that. And other kids have faced more barriers. And we want to make sure, and a lot of these mentoring programs do a great job of addressing that and making sure that we're seeing some of those disparities and creating programs that are really focused on equity.
Would you say that the need has grown during the pandemic or not?
You know, we don't have data, and sometimes I'm hesitant to speculate without data, but I think anecdotally we would say yes, without a doubt, because of that connectivity factor, right? Again, as we mentors are a great, really structured way to support kids, but so are teachers and counselors and coaches and youth group leaders, and we know that kids aren't having that same level of interaction with those support networks. And so can a mentor help to supplement or fill some of that in? Absolutely. Do we know that a lot of these programs, wow, have they been innovative in trying to work in a virtual world? I think a lot of mentoring programs in the past didn't do a tremendous amount. They were tiptoeing that way, but like everything else, they've leapfrogged. But yes, that connectivity component, we know we keep hearing from teachers, parents, and the kids themselves that it's tough right now. This is hopefully one way to address that, and we think that we'll be able to wrap our data research and evaluation folks around just to understand how big of a problem that is going forward. But we're pretty sure it's just accentuated during the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. And during National Mentoring Month, of course, again, is a time where we're trying to get people involved. And we know that real life involvement, that, you know, first, that face-to-face contact, that's a really important part of it. And you sort of touched on this. Has that been a major barrier? And what are organizations doing to get around that?
Yes. You know, again, I think sometimes we think about those great experiences where you and your mentee are going to go, you know, fill in the blank, go to a park, go to a basketball game, go to get ice cream or coffee or whatever that might be. And that's a bigger challenge right now. And so the programs have done a great job of helping to think about what are some of those ways. Maybe you could have a driveway visit or a park visit that is socially distanced, because we know that one-on-one contact is important, and then also weave in those virtual opportunities. Right now, we know it's not either or, but we hope it's both and, that it goes beyond just the digital engagement and can really be involved real life. Because, you know, anyone that's worked with kids, many of us, or even has been a kid, you know, the body language, the facial expressions, all of that plays into the interaction. And even though we can see some of that on the screen, you can't see all of it.
Mm-hmm. That nonverbal that I'm sure a lot of us are missing anyway.
Absolutely. And the joy that comes from that. Sometimes, you know, not every kid is a big extrovert, but sometimes it's the little smiles or the upturn in the eyes, that kind of thing, that shows that they're really making that connection. And that's a little, those nuances. Responses are a little harder, much harder to read virtually.
Mm-hmm. What information or advice should people have if they're hearing this and are interested in mentoring, but just have no idea where to get started?
Sure. Well, first, obviously, we have some information on our website, which is IYI.org, and then /mentor. We also feed into that national network, which is the National Mentoring Partnership. And you can get to it from our site, or you can go directly there, the National Mentoring Partnership. They have a tremendous amount of information on this research and on ways to engage and what to expect and questions you might have. There's a tremendous amount of information out there. And then I might ask around again, you know, when we talk about National Mentoring Month or mentoring programs, I am always just so encouraged by the people who will pipe up and say, oh, you know, a few years ago, I just had this morning, a woman said several years ago, she was a mentor and that mentoring, she did that for about 6 years. And that was that the young person has gone off to college and she's like, she just Facebook friended me, right? Like she just reached out and we've started, we shared holiday cards and we've had a couple of conversations and she talked about how meaningful that was for you. So ask around. My guess is a lot of folks might know someone who's been a mentor and that might be your best frame of reference. Cause you know, the stories of benefits just abound out there.
Yeah. Certainly important work. Tammy Silverman, CEO and President of Indiana Youth Institute, thank you so much for taking some time today.
Always my pleasure. Thank you.
We'll be back after a quick break. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. For this part of the show, we're talking about a big announcement recently made in Indiana. Due to the pandemic, the NCAA unveiled plans to have the entire men's basketball tournament played in Indiana. We're talking to David Pierce, IUPUI Associate Professor and Director of the Sports Innovation Institute. Thank you, David, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So we're talking last week, we heard the information, the NCAA tournament, the entire tournament will be held in Indiana, most of it in Indianapolis, but there will also be some games held at IU and Purdue. What's your take on, you know, the investment, the directed investment that Indiana has sort of taken in sports and sports investment? Has this helped to make this happen?
Yeah, it really has. And this is an ultimate kind of payoff moment for that, obviously in a way that no one predicted as those investments were being made. But, you know, we've always thought about the downtown area as, you know, a great location, you know, for fans and for media. But now all of those same assets and resources are sitting there perfectly positioned to, you know, for example, house all the teams in a hotel within a skywalk away from where they need to practice or play their games. You know, you've got enough practice court space in the convention center. Everything's connected, and so it becomes very convenient. There's a few, you know, games that need to happen up in Lafayette and Bloomington, you know, just to get through those first rounds. But ultimately, the infrastructure and the investment and the thought leadership in sports is really going to pay off here for this situation. So they're, you know, everything lined up where Indianapolis was, you know, going to be the perfect location for a Final Four, but now the whole thing.
It's pretty incredible and big news that definitely went national last week. Is the infrastructure in place? I know we're going to have to do some tweaking to make sure, because this is a lot of games, right?
Yeah, so you've got 67 games over about a 20-day time frame. So, you know, the schedule, you know, from the fan perspective is going to look a lot different, you know, in terms of what time games are on, when games are on, what days they're on. But I am sure that, you know, Turner and CBS are going to figure out the optimal way to do that and probably actually create a more, a better viewing experience overall, being able to put games and times in different spots.
Yeah. Will it be unusual? I mean, will it be a different viewing experience for people that are usual, that usually tune in to March Madness?
Yeah, the schedule hasn't been released yet, but some projections I've seen, I mean, I would expect there to be some Monday and Tuesday games, or as typically all the games happen Thursday through Sunday. just because of the number of venues available and when things have to get done. I think there's going to be games, during the week, for example, that we wouldn't typically see.
Now, what do you think, and what have you heard about the steps to bring this tourney to Indiana? You know, I did join some of the press calls, and they were a little vague on, what went on behind the scenes. You know, how hard do you think people have been working to make this happen?
Well, I think what they're saying in the press releases is that the NCAA, had reached out, to the Sports Corp. But I also think if you look at the work that the Sports Corp did to create kind of a preseason bubble, I mean, they were already thinking this direction, back in May and June in terms of how to create a solution for even just some of the preseason games. So there was already thought and already work being done from the Indiana Sports Corp side. I don't think this is something that just, popped up on a random email out of the blue. I mean, I think they were thinking in this direction for quite a while.
and when the pandemic hit, like you said, people have been thinking about this since May. Sports was kind of one of the first visible things that people were really pining for and wondering what was going to happen, obviously with the 500 being pushed back so many times and just the unknown. What do you think we've learned with the pandemic in mind as it relates to, sports?
Well, I think we learned that it was the first thing to go, or it was the first thing that was visible, right? It was the first to go, and it's going to be one of the last things to fully come back. I mean, yeah, sure, there are sports on TV currently, but you can watch any game, and when you see 6,000 fans in the stands in a 70,000-seat arena or still no fans in the stands, it's not fully back yet. So, first to go, last to fully come back. So for all of those working and, trying to make a living in the sport industry, I don't care what level of position or leadership level, it's difficult. Now, there are sectors of it that are coming back at different paces. I think youth sport is really the first thing to come back full bore, Grand Park up in Westfield and some of our other kind of destination tournament locations, have come back, pretty darn quickly, even by late summer. So those are some wins within the sport industry. But these things where you've got, larger numbers of people trying to gather. So, I mean, anything that's in the events industry and space right now is still going to be a little bit slower on the comeback.
Do you think that anything will be forever changed because of the pandemic, or can we expect, or what do you think might be changed because of this experience?
I mean, I think, that there's a lot of innovation going on right now just in the broadcast experience. I think the broadcast experience is going to change for the better permanently. I mean, I do think we will get back to a point where, the people are gathering, in venues to watch events. But I think some innovation in kind of that in-home or on-phone viewing experience that probably we were going to get over the next 10 years, I think we got right away, and we're seeing it now. So that's, that's exciting for just the general sports fan. But we may still be, a year and a half out here before we're, back to capacity in some of these venues, just for people's comfort level as well.
What can we expect as far as an economic impact? I feel like I've heard some numbers, but there's still a lot that we don't know, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's only going to be a fraction of what it would have been with a major Final Four weekend, right? So economic impact is really measured with the out of towner visitor dollars that are injected into the community. And so, without fans and people coming in from out of town, you just, at the level of, 100,000 people or whatever that number ends up being, you're just not going to have that new visitor dollar coming into the city. However, you are booking, looks like around 7,000 hotel rooms, like pretty much the whole downtown city block of hotels is going to be full, right? And so that's a good thing. So you actually have more teams and people related to the players, whether it's the families or aunts and uncles and those types of things. So, I mean, there will be a nominal, there are some economic impact dollars coming in, but not at the level of what you would have around a full Final Four weekend.
But still, I would imagine that, you know, officials are pretty happy about any tourism coming back to a city like Indianapolis after.
Yeah. Yeah, something's better than nothing. You do have to, you know, if you're really getting into the mechanics of an economic impact study, you would also have to take into account the events that were displaced. So, you know, Visit Indy has announced that they've worked with other event organizers on moving those events to other times of the year to accommodate for the usage of space in the convention center. So, you know, whatever, you know, economic impact is occurring, you would, in a pretty tight, rigorous economic impact study, you would need to subtract out what you're not bringing in by displacing those other events.
Well, we certainly heard a lot from tourism officials that Indianapolis has done a great job of being able to bring in some of these mainly sports tourneys that weren't able to be facilitated in other cities.
Yeah, and I think that was an early win, too. There was a major volleyball tournament, I believe, that happened in the convention center. So they'd already kind of gotten their feet wet and practiced a little bit about how do we, you know, use the space safely and differently. So that was a little, but not anywhere near what this is going to be, but at least there was some level of practice and thinking that way.
What are you expecting as far as fans go? We've heard, you know, from the city that they just don't, it's too early to know. And what can we maybe expect, though, do you think?
I think what you can expect is if there are fans, it will be extremely limited and it would only be for the Final Four. I don't think you'll see anything in the first and second rounds. I don't think you'll see anything for the Sweet 16 and the Elite Eight. And if there is anything, you know, maybe it looked like the national championship game the football national championship game that was played on Monday the 11th. But I wouldn't hold out a whole lot of hope for that.
What does this do, you know, for Lafayette, for Bloomington? I mean, they're going to be games played in those places as well. Will this help out some of those communities?
I think pretty limited, you know, with just the kind of the what the NCAA calls the tier one people. So a maximum of, I think, 420 people at 6 tickets per traveling party of the team, which includes your trainers and medical staff and managers and players and coaches. So, you know, other than the fact that, you know, your name's getting out there, you know, games happening in Bloomington, in West Lafayette. I mean, I don't from an economic perspective, I don't. They're really just there providing this logistical support for the event. Now, Indianapolis is different because, everyone's going to identify Indianapolis as the place that did this. And so there's a lot of, and it's basically going to be on TV for 2.5 straight weeks. So I think there, even though you're losing out a little bit on the traditional economic impact metric, there's going to be a lot gained in just the visibility and marketing for the city of Indianapolis and central Indiana.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of my questions. You know, what does this do for Indiana's basketball legacy? It helps, I would imagine.
Yeah, for sure. So you've kind of got, you know, the basketball legacy side of it, you know, sure, you know, solidified. Everyone identifies Indiana with basketball, you know, but there's also this, you know, message that I'm sure Visit Indy and Sports Corp and those folks are working on diligently about, you know, kind of the innovative nature of central Indiana, and that, you know, we're back, we're open, we have major events here, you can too. So I'm sure that the city is going to be leveraging that as much as they possibly can.
Yes, of course. And I mean, it's exciting. I mean, we think back to the, you know, the Super Bowl and how much excitement there was around that. I mean, even somebody that's not into basketball can really sort of get behind an event like this.
Yeah, it'll be missing, you know, some of the things that you're able to go down and interact with, right? Downtown, right? Remember there was the race cars on the circle and you had different fan fests and those types of things. I think that stuff will be extremely limited to non-existent. So there is a little bit of it. It'll still, you know, it's great, but it won't feel quite as, you can't really interact with it as much if it's just games going on inside an arena that you can't get into. But it is what it is.
What are you excited about? You know, a move like this, something that's never been done before like this. Is this exciting in your world?
Yeah. So on the academic side, you know, we really, as a professor at IUPUI, we really promote and tie ourselves very closely to all the events that go on in the city. And really, I don't think there's a better place to learn how to be in sport business and sport management in Indianapolis. I mean, it's the perfect location to be a student. And it's been unfortunate that now for almost a year, our students really haven't had any opportunities to engage with that or leverage that in the way that they typically would. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that there are increased volunteer opportunities that come out of this for our students to get plugged in and get the experience that they need to kind of, you know, project their careers forward.
And certainly a good example of innovation that students can study.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, when you're, you know, getting to do something that's never been done this way, that really gets us out of the traditional mold of here's how an event operates and it always operates this way. And we're going to do it, you know, we're going to do it this way because that's the way it's always been done in the past. And so as a director of a sports innovation institute and trying to get students to adopt that creativity and growth mindset, I love the fact that they'll be able to interact with something that's new and fresh and that people are building it as they fly it. I think that's great.
So I understand that there's, you know, an education initiative as well for grade school and middle school youth as we move forward towards the tournament. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the NCAA has really increased their educational initiatives in the communities in which they host their tournament. There's a third grade reading program that is already started, targeted there at that third grade level. There's also for fifth graders the entire month of March on demand in kind of an asynchronous learning environment. There is going to be a whole bunch of information around science, technology, engineering, and math, and how that relates to basketball and sports and picking your brackets. There's going to be a lot of really good interviews and content with, you know, famous basketball players like Tamika Catchings. There's a lot of learning initiatives within STEM as it relates to sports. That's going to be targeted towards fifth graders. And then at the high school level, there's going to be a two-day virtual event that occurs on the 2nd and the 5th of April, right there at the Final Four, that Friday and the Monday. And the focus there is really going to be on the importance of innovation and creativity and also sports innovation. So a variety of different things are going to be going on, but one of which is we're going to have students from across the country that have competed in a sports innovation challenge, really targeted at solving the national shortage of sports officials. They're going to be giving Shark Tank, you know, style pitches, and, you know, the audience is going to get a chance to vote on what they think the best ideas are to solve that really important problem in the sports industry. So that's really going to be targeted at high school students. So again, if you've got third graders, you got fifth graders. And a lot of this stuff, again, is going to sit on demand. So even if you've got, you know, a fourth grader or a sixth grader, all of this stuff is still going to be relevant. And so my understanding is very clearly called out on the NCAA Final Four website. There's going to be links to all these different opportunities. So the NCAA has really, you know, done a lot better and done a lot more and is much more robust in this space of education kind of around their marquee event.
Any other thoughts today, David?
No, I just think it's a great, you know, a great story. You know, the storytelling opportunities out of this for Indianapolis are going to be great. You know, a national opportunity for a national marketing campaign over 2.5 weeks. So even though we're losing some of those out-of-town visitor dollars, you know, ideally we'll come out ahead in the long run.
David Pierce, Associate Professor at IUPUI and Director of Sports Innovation Institute. Thank you so much for joining today.
Yep, thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. Thanks for listening. This is All In.